The Press Box is here to catch you up on the latest media stories. Hosted by Brian Curtis and David Shoemaker, these guys have the insight on the biggest stories you care about. Check out The Press Box on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Just because you wrestle alligators for a living doesn't mean you should have the skin of one. Say goodbye to dry and cracked skin with Old Spice Super Hydration Body Wash with vitamin B3. Made for 24/7 renewing moisturization with daily use. With scents of vanilla and shea, people will think you've taken up candle making as one of your hobbies. And there is nothing wrong with that. Old Spice Super Hydration Body Wash. Shop Old Spice now.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, it's me, him, and Henry Kissinger. Fuck you. It's Andy Greenwald.
That's my favorite intro ever.
Oh, welcome to the weekly episode of Little Lord Fuckleroy. I am Chris Ryan. I'm joined by Andy Greenwald. We're here to talk about the fourth episode of Succession. That's the fourth
really
one, right?
It's flying by now. Yeah,
the lion in the meadow. What an episode. We got a lot to break down here, Andy. I can go through quickly the plot points, or we can talk generalities first. It's just like pretty easy to go through this one because not a ton happened. Mm-hmm. This week on Succession, we got some new blood in the form of Adrian Brody's Josh Aronson character, which I have quite a bit to say about. Logan and Kendall go out to a private island that maybe is in Long Island, but also requires a flight. Mm-hmm. So are they in Portugal? I don't know. We'll break that down. To plead their case to a 4% shareholder, this guy Josh, the whole thing takes on a kind of Waiting for Godot feeling, with Josh stress testing Logan and Kendall in both intellectual, emotional, and physical ways. Meanwhile, back in the city, Roman is looking for leverage on Kendall, buying a photo of a homeless man that he and Kendall paid to get Kendall's name tattooed on his forehead during Kendall's bachelor party. And Shiv is trying to assert herself as president of Waystar Royco but is running into headwinds, even from her father, who gave her the job in the first place. And lastly, Tom is spinning out as his imminent trip to prison, I guess, is coming up on him. The biggest thing to talk about, Andy, is this tete-a-tete that Kendall and Logan... that Kendall, Logan, and Josh Aronson have. Where the fuck were they?
Right. Good. Let's start there. I mean, in terms of location, they were absolutely somewhere out on the East End. Like, they were somewhere, like, whether that was Shelter Island or it's off-season Orient, unclear. Right. But that's absolutely where it was. Like, no,
it's a private island that you have to take a flight to, though. So do you have to fly to Shelter Island?
No, you could swim. You could take a little boat. It's not very exclusive. So look, I mean, do I know a lot about a lot of things? Sure. Thanks. Yeah, I do.
Right.
Do I know a lot about the private island economy? I do not. And I think it's interesting that we are having this, like, if this was a different season of Succession, I think if it was meant to be somewhere more exotic, they would have filmed it someplace more exotic. You know what I mean? But because this is the COVID season, I'm like, well, they definitely could drive to this place they pretended to fly to, and maybe that was helpful. So I just wasn't sure.
Was it like, is this like off of the Carolinas somewhere? Like, is it somewhere?
I don't think it was that far. I think that, first of all, I think these people perhaps abused the privilege of private air travel a touch. You know, yeah. I mean, who am I to judge from this vantage point here in, you know, in La La Land? But did they need to take two fully gassed up Lear jets to essentially, you know, go to the Hamptons? Probably not. But people do that, I'm sure. So I don't know. I do think that it is meant to be close because it's suggested that this was meant to be a New York City meeting, but due to the potentially fake illness of Josh's daughter, they had to trek out there.
Right. So sometimes what makes a good Succession episode doesn't always make great logical storytelling. And I thought I would mention that off the top here because that jumps out a couple of times in this episode. Mm-hmm. I'll just say it's not really a criticism, like I didn't enjoy myself watching, but you know, episodic television, regardless of whether it's serialized or not, has to sometimes do soft resets to kind of keep everybody's favorite characters somehow interacting. And this show,
all the balls in the air. Yeah.
This show does that with such aplomb. Like usually, I mean, they like most of these episodes, most of the best episodes involve, for some reason, all of these people had to gather in X place. Mm-hmm. And that's been a little bit more challenging, I think, for this season, maybe because of what you mentioned with COVID, but maybe also because to keep pushing the story forward, you know, Kendall has to be this antagonist, but they still need to interact with him. You know what yep. I mean? So after spitting in Kendall's day planner, following the in utero town hall, you know, Shiv is still finds herself on a conference call with Kendall, like moments later. So there's little things like that. You know, Roman kind of refuses to sign the letter about Kendall in the previous episode because, you know, he has some affection for him, but is the person going out scouting for blackmail on him in the next episode. It's good TV. I like it. It just doesn't... Did you find that it was maybe not always tracking in that way?
Yes. 1,000,000% yes. And I think it's worth noting, hopefully in a non-pejorative way, like the seams are showing a little bit in this season. As a fan of both this show and of television storytelling in general, that doesn't bother me in the slightest. I think that it is a mistake. It is a mistaken reading of Succession, as well as probably an indictment of just how our hype culture has overtaken everything else, to suggest that this show is somehow transcendent due to its brilliant plot mechanics. Mm-hmm. This isn't Breaking Bad. And by the way, if you poke around at Breaking Bad, even Breaking Bad isn't the Breaking Bad that we often talk about. This show has never purported to reinvent the wheel in terms of weekly dramatic storytelling. What it does is it gives you the most elegant and fucking funny wheel you've ever imagined, and God, is it pretty to watch it spin. So that's how I approach the show. And because of that, it doesn't really bother me to see Jesse Armstrong and his writers twist themselves into increasing pretzel logic just to get where they need to get in order to achieve what they want to achieve. Mm-hmm. I do think, and I've been saying this, I think, pretty much since the season started, so I don't want to repeat myself too much, but I think that there are two major factors at play that are affecting maybe our experience of that of this. One is there's the COVID thing. We don't know.
Yeah,
we're going to be talking about it.
I know that there was a reason for it dramatically, but I really enjoyed the Adrian Brody's character being like, "Why don't we go outside? It's more comfortable outside."
Yeah, it is literally winter. I mean, that is the light we were talking about that I think leached us of childhood pleasure by growing up on the East Coast. You know what I mean? Like the dusky seagrass just sort of wilting. And then they're like, oh, the sun was so hot. I'm like, dog, I've been in the sun in February in New York State. Not that hot.
Yeah.
Not that hot.
But he can, so, I mean, we still don't know. He might be off the coast of Portugal for all we know, you know?
That's true. I feel like, are we sponsored by Portugal
this
week?
Like, yeah, I don't know. I'm just saying. I don't know.
Kai, does the Portuguese Tourism Board have a stake in the show, and could we make that happen? So that's part of it. The other part of it is something that I alluded to last week, which is, yeah, the cell phone has already ruined visual storytelling and as an excuse to get people together. But now you have a corner that they have intentionally painted themselves into where the characters who ought to be in the same room with each other and maybe are even in the same quarantine bubble can't be in the same room with each other because they are at active war. Mm-hmm. So that's how we end up with two things that did definitely feel a little wonky. One was, you know, there's a bomb and only you, Murtaugh, and you, Riggs, can defuse it.
Right.
Like, okay. Is that absolutely the case? Fine. I mean, but so much of TV storytelling is that. And then, you know, I think it leans into it. There's a little bit of like hanging a lantern on it when there's the implication that maybe this was all a setup, you know, that maybe this was intentional. So it's preposterous, but what's the alternative? Brian Cox and Jeremy Strong spend a season never interacting. No, we don't want
that.
No,
the real version of Succession is these people never see each other because it's all lawyers. Like, their lawyers wouldn't let them speak to one another. Their lawyers wouldn't let them make public statements like this. Their lawyers wouldn't let them get on the phone with one another or play in utero during their town hall appearances. That would not happen. It would just be lawyer, 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 lawyer. But, I mean, I love the fact that the show is just like, these people are maybe only ever allowed to be with one another because they just can't function in the world without one another. I love the central conceit of this show. Don't get me wrong. You know, I think even like the Adrian Brody character himself was kind of like, that's a very TV thing where it's like this guy that we have never heard of before is now very important.
Yeah.
You know, and that's totally fine. Like I was like so thrilled to see Adrian Brody. I was so thrilled with this character. I want to talk a lot about how many layers he was wearing because I charted that.
I'm coming back to that. We are circling back to that when we do a deeper Josh dive.
But it was like definitely like the episode starts and they're like, we have to go see Josh Aronson. And, you know, if you're like a serious TV watcher, you're just like, should I know who this is? Was this guy mentioned before? And he was not.
Yes. And I think that there's also, that speaks to the other kind of slightly wonky thing, which is the nature of the shareholder revolt, aka mm-hmm. the single existential defining threat of season two, is utterly opaque at this point and almost ludicrous. You know, it is absolutely it's like a dimmer switch, yeah. You know, in Shiv's fancy apartment where it's just like, well, now it's important, but now it's not. I mean, I know as much about the inner workings of publicly traded companies as I do about private islands, which is to say nothing. I was going to say as much as you know about Portuguese beach destinations, but you keep talking about it. So I feel like there's something you want to get into. So all that being said, I could be wrong. But from my layman's perspective,
yeah,
what world is the Roy family still credible? Like the fact that this shareholder thing, which was so urgent a week ago, is now only intermittently urgent, and also that there's still potentially a strong play for them to regain control, even though it is absolute chaos, up to and including an FBI raid that almost again, speaking about like hanging a lantern on something, that like, which is the writer's room term of like, is there a flaw? Let's steer into it. Let's point it out.
Yeah.
This episode begins with them being like, a dramatic escalation that is now going to quiet for a few weeks. I mean, they're admitting it, you know, but again, all that said, I don't actually care about, I mean, ask yourself this question too, if you are a Succession fan who's just like, well, that's not logical. Do you care? Do you want to get into it with Stewie and Sandy and figure out like what what percentage of the board believes in it? Or do you want Adrian Brody to emerge, you know, like he's in the Burlington Coat Factory outlet sale and dominate the episode? Like, yeah. I would rather have him dropped out of nowhere and give us what we got. I am less worried about how we got there.
So I thought that the way that the Josh meeting played out was so wonderful because they so leaned into the awkwardness of the moment, you know, that they have these extended, almost excruciating long silences when Josh ever leaves Logan and Kendall together. You have all this performance going on. You know, we talk about unreliable narrators in fiction. I think we were seeing a lot of unreliable action on the screen. You know, you don't really know why Josh has summoned them. Is he doing it purely in an effort to unnerve them for the purposes of Sandy and Stewie? Is he doing it because he legitimately wanted to see whether or not they could smooth over their obvious differences with one another? Did he actually want to see if Logan was physically up to doing this, this job still? And he was like, I'm going to make this guy walk for 2 hours in the sun and see what happens, you know?
And I really liked that aspect of the episode. It's not, for all of the wonderful things that Succession does so well on TV, it rarely gets into that kind of nebulous, artistic, cinematic, not magical realism, but it doesn't really get weird. They say weird things, but it doesn't get weird. And I think that that kind of dream logic that was always pulsing through The Sopranos is what elevated the show, you know? And even though some of the dream episodes were a drag, like, the show operated on multiple planes of perception and existence or was interested in that, and that kind of kept it going. And Succession, has never gone in that direction. I'm not suggesting there should be a David Lynch season of Succession, but walking through the maze mm-hmm. on this island that we don't know, could be Portugal, could be. I'm not sure. I didn't notice any, you know, fried fish balls. On
I'm just, I don't know where those cliffs would be in Long Island.
But true. But there was that, it did elevate the scene because we didn't know and they mm-hmm. didn't know. And it was low-key unsettling in a way that I appreciated. I don't think the show plays that note very often, and I was excited to see that it was interested in doing so.
Who do you think Josh is? So, I mean, basically, yeah. he mentions briefly in a kind of, when he's going at Logan a little bit, it was like, you think I'm some dipshit who had a good night at a casino, which makes me think he's like a, maybe like a Haralabob Vulgaris type, like online poker champion or something. Well, like,
He's very rich, though. Like, uh-huh. He's like, this
I think,
is just...
I think Bob's pretty rich, too.
I mean, I don't know him at all, but I'm saying yeah. like $350 million stake is part of his holdings, and apparently he owns an island that straddles the continental divide between yeah. Massachusetts and Portugal.
And he's got like just like fuck you money to spend on vests and scarves and cardigans and shirts that he's going to wear at once.
Well, okay. We're going to have that conversation. Chris, there's only one other person in my experience on planet Earth who is as fond of layering as Josh on Succession.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to him right now.
That's right.
Chris Ryan is the layer god. I know that you have a fan base of heads and people are like very invested in your sartorial decisions, generally post-coital, whatever. Like there's a lot of information about you is out there uh-huh. and people love it and they celebrate it. What I think is not talked about enough or celebrated enough is that look, you have mixed feelings about Los Angeles. That's not a secret. But in some ways, Chris, it is something you were born
You know
to
what
live
the thing is that you know how some people are like, I go day to night?
Yeah.
I go mountain to desert.
Chris, listen, people who don't live in Los Angeles don't understand the weather here because, yes, it's nice all the time, but sometimes it's chilly and then it's not chilly, but it's chilly in the morning and in the evening. What are we doing? This is not a real challenge for adult humans, but it gets in your head,
yeah.
you know, especially if you've lived your whole life on the East Coast being like, aha, the calendar declares it is January 20th. Thus, I will zip myself up into this tauntaun skin and not remove it until mid-April.
Right.
Like, that's how you operate. Here, one needs to do what you do, Chris. Like, I didn't even understand the possibilities because I was with my like base, what would Roman call it? Poor person thinking. I was like, there are shirts. And there are jackets. Whoa, guess what? Newsflash. There's shackets.
So,
there's jerts. Chris wears a t-shirt, a button-down, a vest, maybe a shirt jacket. He always has optionality. He is what the NFL coordinators are looking for. And finally, I saw your genius reflected on the small screen.
Representation matters. You know, it's important. I really, it meant a lot to be seen. That guy, so Josh goes from my, you know, my freeze frame analysis,
yeah.
Josh Aronson wearing t-shirt,
right,
button up,
totally.
Cardigan, scarf.
That was the
hoodie,
play.
Vest, which is, so that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 layers plus a scarf.
It is a legendary torso performance, you know, the likes of which I don't know if I've ever seen. From that alone.
You know, because there's all those, like, you know, you watch the behind the scenes for something like, this is how long it took this guy to get made up like an orc in Lord of the Rings. Every morning, you would get up at 2 a.m. to get like the, it's like, what was Brody's process? Imagine how long it took to put all those layers on.
Do you want me to tell you his process? That's his house. Those are his clothes, and he was very excited because those may have been his clams. I just, there aren't too many times where there is a from jump, perfect marriage between performer and character like
yeah.
this. You know, I don't think anyone thought this because Adrian Brody's career has been surprising and circuitous in ways not like other Oscar winners. But if anyone was like, why is Adrian Brody joining the show and he hasn't even showed up until the fourth episode? Well, now you see why. I mean, there are two kinds of easy parts for actors. There are ones where they're mailing it in and there are ones where they're like, this is what they do, you know, who they were born to be. And he's phenomenal in this. There's a kind of like cockeyed looseness to the whole thing, you know, total comfort in his skin. other than the fact that he's covered that skin with 19 layers of Gore-Tex. You know, and you need a performer who is going to act like he owns the place when he is sitting at a small folding table with two Emmy winners.
Let's talk. Can we talk a little bit about that table?
Yeah, oh, so I can't wait.
These guys take a, they leave Adrian Brody's lovely house. They're walking out along the dunes. The Beatles come up. There's some conversation about...
What's Logan say? Good band.
Good band.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal line reading.
Before that, there's a little bit of conversation about purchasing something called Gojo and like bad UI and good UI and good content and bad content. I'm sure that will come up, but...
As the former IT guy for Grantland, Chris, you were all over that, right? Like that was your language.
But they're walking and they're walking. You know, maybe it's just a walk. Maybe it's just to get the sea air. Maybe it's to stress test Logan to some extent. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of like, okay, what's going on? I want you to tell me a little bit about how you felt when those guys turn around and there's the lunch table is set and we are about to get this al fresco dining experience.
I felt so many feelings. My first thought, I'm going to be honest with you, was disappointment that the pitcher had like minted tea in it when what you want is a crisp muscadet to really pop with that shellfish. You know, you want something that tastes of the land, wherever that land may be, because clearly it's TBD. My second thought was, this is such a glorious representation of true, true wealth. It's not the glass box house that costs millions of dollars or the no doubt obscenely heated pool that the formerly feverish daughter is now happily hopping into, even though the temperature is hovering in the 40s outside. It's you walk to a place that doesn't seem particularly convenient, mm-hmm. and there's a platter of clams waiting for you. It's that other people's discomfort is so outside of your purview that they are just standing at the ready with things like this in a place that it doesn't make sense to have them. I love that. I also want to eat that food because it mm-hmm. looks amazing. I too would like to go for a thoughtful, solitary Andrew Wyeth-like hike through the Eastern Seaboard, but then
have, get a lobster, yeah.
just have it there for me at the end of my journey. Also, this might go less commented on. I did notice, and no surprises why, this was the first that I remember episode of Succession where the Roy's like, just, it's not even soft anti-Semitism, but just like baked in. Is mentioned, you know, in terms of who's on what floor of the building. But then Logan is just like to Josh, like you're a city boy, like need your bagels.
Yeah, right.
Which I thought was a fascinating dig and revealing of so much about the character. But also, Logan, you've been at a Dundee for a bunch of years. Josh laid out a plate of trafe. Do you understand that? Like, if he cares as much about bagels as you think he does, he is not serving you shellfish. That's not on.
Right.
That's not on. So, okay. I had to get that off my chest.
So, I mean, Logan also with some opinions about what his experiences would be like in prison just reveals a little bit about him. You know, it's like, it's not like anybody has any like misgivings about who that guy is. But I thought that whole exchange that they have on the way back was so brilliant. Both Logan being like, here's your situation. I've got the family. I've got the raisin. I've got the kiddies. You lost. And then he starts wheezing. And there's that really cool shot of just the sort of dead trees or the brush and his heaving breathing.
Yeah.
You know, and then he's starting to get weaker and weaker. And Logan's like, your fucking brains are scrambled eggs, man. Like you are 600. Yeah. Kendall says that to Logan. He's like, you're 600 years old, you know, you're fucking busting this guy's chops about being Jewish. You think you're like, you're basically, you're dead. I killed you that day and you're dead now. And you can see basically that they unwittingly walk into whatever Josh's trap was. Cause he's clearly going to meet Stewie. That's the person that he's like, I have guests coming. And so yeah, he always knew Stewie was coming. It was either going to be a car wash to see who he was going to choose, or he's just decided like, look at this old man and his crazy son. I'm out of here. They can take a golf cart. I'm waiting for Stewie.
Yeah, I mean, they shit the bet. They did what I clearly Josh thought they might. Maybe not in an even worse degree. He set them up for that, and they delivered. Shout out to Arian Moyed, who plays Stewie. A Hall of Fame guest starring flex by just being seen through a porthole window at the very end of the episode and still getting full
loafers,
credit.
Loafers, no love, socks in like 40
love
degrees.
That.
Yeah,
I do want to talk about, you know, the show continues to find new ways to reveal things that aren't surprising, but are still fascinating to observe in the wild when they happen. You know, it is not news to Succession watchers to say that the performance of family is just another weapon in a successful capitalist arsenal. Like, we know that. We know all of it. And we had it reminded, if we didn't know, I mean, last week with the whole thing with a fishing trip in Roman, I mean, the optics at the airport, we know that. But the facility to which Logan could say things that he would never say to his son, to Josh, in order to assure him that he's going to maintain control of the company, it's still breathtaking. And it opens up opportunity. I mean, I sometimes I feel like a joke going into sports metaphors because that's not my forte. And also, you know, that is your forte. But it opens up the floor. You know what I mean? It gives players a chance to do what they do best. And in this case, the players are the actors. And for people who say, who are still on the fence, but probably aren't listening to this podcast, honestly, like, where is the, who am I rooting for? What is the emotion here? You know, where's the pathos or the love story or whatever that people often use as markers in television shows? It's on Jeremy Strong's face when his father is saying he's a good boy. I mean, that is as yearning and desperate and sad and pathetic and moving as nearly anything else in a drama you're going to see this year. And it's a showcase for that.
Yeah.
I also do want to say I do not share, I think, any of the traits of the relationship between that. My father and I do not mirror the relationship that we saw this episode.
Sure.
However, there is one thing I have to point out, which is that my father, who is also over the age of 80 years old, walks in public and refuses help in exactly the same way that Brian Cox did in this episode. My father walks Manhattan like Walt Whitman writes poetry about Manhattan. Okay? He can't bend his knees.
Right.
But he bestrides the Colossus.
Right.
Of Fifth Avenue. And I'm like, Dad, you know, the light hasn't even started blinking yet. I'm fine. You know, like it invigorates him. And I think it is clearly some sort of like performance alpha play. And I would say to Kendall, not even the Evian would have helped.
Has your dad been to Manhattan since like the bike lanes really popped off?
Oh my God. See, I don't even want to know that. Yes, they were there last week to see the stirring revival of Carolina Change. I mean, they stay seeing important Broadway shows. And I stay not asking them how they drove there or drove back because I don't want to hear about it.
Right, right. Okay, so anything else you want to say about the Kendall, Josh, Logan meeting?
The only thing that's remaining, I mean, I thought it was beautifully shot. I thought it's worth noting, and I don't have their names in front of me, the directors of the episode, the married couple that directed American Splendor. You remember the Paul Giamatti movie?
That was Sherry Springer and Robert Pulcini.
Yeah, married couple, great directors, indie directors, happy to see them getting some shine. I thought that whole sequence was really well shot and really well done. Very eager to have Brody in the mix, hopefully more this season, because it did address the note that I had last week about, like, let's get these siloed off at war with each other weirdos into other spaces quickly.
Yeah.
So that we can see their behavior reflected in other people's eyes. I think it's crucial. Underneath this, I mean, this is a podcast, so I can throw out a small concern troll, remains one central thing that I think the show keeps the centrifuge spinning to keep our eyes away from, which is, do we care who wins the shareholder revolt?
Well, like, I mean, that kind of gets to a little bit of the overall theme of what we've been talking about this season is, does how we talk about Succession somehow dictate what Succession is? You know, if you talk about a show once a week, if you talk about it on The Ringer, we talk about it three times a week. If you talk about, if you write about it a lot, and there are New Yorker profiles and New York Magazine profiles dedicated to Jesse Armstrong's brilliance, and, you know, it's all about these, how this family is representative of the rotten core of capitalism and the media and everything else, then, you know, there's going to be some scrutiny. If it's like, and we've said this again and again, it's more, you know, sometimes it leans more Veep than it does Sopranos. Then you won't be under, like, if it's Veep was never under that level of scrutiny, I don't think. Like, Veep was, like, appreciated as a masterpiece of comedy, but I don't think people were like, did Veep make sense this week? Do we understand what Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character wants, you know?
What is Selina Meyer's remaining path to the presidency?
Yeah.
There is an appetite to watch this show like it's not just that it's Breaking Bad, but like it's the NCAA tournament. You know, I don't think that I personally, that's not how I want to watch it. But I also don't think that is ultimately as respectful of the show, because I don't think the show wants to be that. I don't think it has interest in that.
Which isn't the same thing as saying that they aren't paying attention to the plot. You know what I mean?
True.
Like, it's not the same thing. I think that you will probably see, like, Gojo will come up again. Josh Aronson will come up again. Like, the homeless man with the tattoo will probably wind up coming up again. Ravenhead will come up again. Like, all of this stuff in this episode, they don't waste shots. It's just that sometimes when you see a field goal attempt, you're like, that was meaningless. And then it winds up being important two episodes later. But do you know what I'm saying by that?
Yes. And I also think it's worth noting, just in terms of how you and I like to talk about TV sometimes, that there is, and I think it's going to become more apparent as the season comes on and then reveals itself, but television watcher, it's not just us generating content as podcasters who think about this stuff and talk about this stuff. I think the average, maybe not the average audience member, but the engaged, even partially, not necessarily extremely online audience member, is so much savvier now than even 5 or 10 years ago. And I think a question that does begin to itch a little bit in people's minds is, what's the shape of this thing? What's the size of this thing? I think that in interviews recently for his book, Brian Cox has basically been saying, yeah, we'll probably do 2 more seasons. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe this is a 4 or 5 season thing. That's interesting. And that does affect how I perceive it, which is not fair, but
in a good or a bad way.
I think it might cause me to sharpen my focus more on some of the machinations, which don't always interest me, because there's the other piece of it, which is, God, the show's fun. God, the show is like Veep. God, the show could go in 100 different directions and run for 100 years. If this show was on Showtime, it's Billions, right? And there's no disrespect against Billions. Like, that's a pretty profitable lane for a show to be in that has lost a main character this year and now can go for 6 more years. You know, that if Succession is a 9 or 10 year commitment, I think that where the decisions made now feel different. And I don't think it is going to be that, but I think it is worth paying attention to that question.
Yeah, I do think that there is. So I don't want to underrate some of the magic of the show, because I will say, if people go back, and you know, this episode of our pod's going up after this episode has just aired, go back and watch, maybe just watch the Josh stuff again, knowing what we know at the end of the episode, and see how he kind of pulls their strings the entire episode. Because he's always got them moving. He's always making them get up and move over and get up and move over and sit next to one another and walk with one another. And once you see that, and he, you know, maybe it'll turn out that he is like a poker player or something. I mean, he does allude to being a gambler or something like that. Like, that kind of study of human behavior is inherent in people who gamble. Like, that's part of playing poker. And I thought it was an interesting move to see him just kind of be like, come over here. No, sit over there. No, let's get up and get some air. Now let's go walk. Now let's go eat. Now let's walk back. But I'm going to walk ahead of you and make you feel like you have to keep up with me. But I'm trying to abandon you. But I keep taking you the wrong way. And is the ocean over there? I can send the cart. You know, it's like a lot of manipulation that doesn't seem that way in the first go around.
No, and you're right to also say that the show doesn't waste its shots. So Josh lives in a glass house where he can watch everything and see everything. And yeah, every part of this is scripted. We know from being with the Roys that everything they do is scripted. You know, that's a good play. That was the smart move. Or at least they then retroactively retcon impulsive, emotional, destructive, abusive behavior into a play.
Yeah.
But here, Josh says, you know, my daughter's sick. She wasn't sick. You need to come visit me. What's that going to mean? And so the Roys try to do a script polish. They try to rewrite it. So Logan and Kendall want to kill each other, so they'll fly separate planes, but they will reconnect on the tarmac and get on the same page. Well, no, they won't. Kendall breaks that, races into the house. The first thing Josh sees is that they are very much not on the same page.
Yeah.
So they're communicating the entire time, and he's reading them, which isn't hard, because they're a large print children's book at this point.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, Then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
I think that before, as a way to pivot off of this plot line, this was a bravura episode from Brian Cox. Like, not just faking having a whatever he was having, just absolutely owning every scene. And you see the spark in his eye when someone pushes back, you know, or fights back. Like he, you know, we shouldn't keep giving people homework like this, but I saw, I don't know where it came, something came across my feed, or I saw online a picture of Brian Cox at the HBO New York premiere mm-hmm. for Succession. And in the pictures, he's just a doofy older guy. He's an actor. He's probably a nice guy or not always a nice guy, whatever, but he's just sort of smiling. And then you see the way this show frames him up, and he's the fucking lion in winter. You know what I mean? Like every piece, every movement is chiseled and chosen. And for as strong as this episode was for him, I don't want to overlook the fact that this was a Rushmore episode for Greg, in my opinion. Not in the focus, but talking about doing a lot with a little.
Yeah.
His plus minus rating. Off the charts.
The morning rum and coke is up there with the doing all of Kendall's cocaine at the bachelor party, or at Tom's bachelor party. That face he makes when he takes that first gulp, he's just like strong.
He's like, I like it. Yeah. He's like, should I chug this? I could chug this. But the two of them together, masterclass in high status, low status performance and finding how to make the scene pop. No one dominates the scene, even though they're coming at it from completely different positions of strength.
Did I miss something, or did he not sign whatever those papers were on screen?
I was a little bit lost there too. But it seemed to me that there was a lot of like, we need to placate the aforementioned lion in winter. You know, like I couldn't tell who said that he did first. Did Tom say it?
Tom did.
Tom's not paying attention. He didn't.
Because he goes up and he's like, Greg's going to sign, or Greg signed, but Ravenhead chewed me out. So I did the two things you wanted to Shiv, and Shiv's like, oh, okay. And then she goes and does Ravenhead.
It could be another example of everyone overlooking Greg. I mean, they all think that that's the easiest thing on their plate to manage.
Right.
Matthew McFadden, such a good actor.
Dude, I mean, he's so good in that Greg scene where he's just like, let's game this out. And he's like, he's melting down. Like, that character is coming apart. Reading the prison blogs, getting ready to go to Otisville.
What are you talking about?
Kosher snack machines.
I have never related to anyone on Succession more than when he talks about how good the first taste of the glass of really cold white wine can be.
My wife said the same thing.
At the end of a day, I was like, for all these people being like, I don't relate to anyone on the show, I was like, yeah, I've never eaten an ortolan with a napkin over my head, but let me tell you what I have done. I've had a very, very cold alcoholic beverage at 5 p.m. and it never fails to satisfy.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a time where you had a cold beer, a cold drink at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, whenever quitting time is for you? But it's like, it's maybe before you start eating. Mm-hmm. And you just wash that man right out of your hair. You know what I mean?
Has there ever been a day? How many days are there in the week?
No,
should I say them in their Latin names?
Has there ever been a time where that hasn't 100% worked all of the time?
I don't know the makeup of our audience, and I don't know if we have people who are generally our age or older or younger.
We have someone named Kaya McMullen who loves a winery. I'm sure she agrees with us.
But let me just say, and I would like to know what Kaya has to say, but I just wanted to say that, like, I feel like I've been doing this drinking thing for like 23 legal years at this point. And look, we all try to game the system. We're all like, what, like Walter White it, like, what is the breakdown of feeling good now and not feeling bad tomorrow? And what's a
being able to sleep,
and matching?
Yeah, right.
Going to sleep, which becomes an issue as
liquor
you
before
age
beer.
Like we do, all of that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you guys, all of you Dr. Steve Brules in the lab, you know what I mean? Like, just just mixing up the medicine. You might not want to hear this, but the ice cold light beer, not like a Coors Light, but I mean like a lighter, like a Mexican style beer.
What's wrong with a Coors Light?
No, that's fine too. I'm just saying it doesn't, I'm not, whatever your pleasure. I'm just saying not like a triple Juice Wolf IPA or whatever. I'm saying that cold lager or Pilsner beer at 5 p.m. is as good as it's going to get. And you might as well quit there. That is the only 100% approval rating I've ever found for alcohol. That's it.
Kai, any notes on drinking before we go ahead of the rest of our Succession pod?
Honestly, no. I think you guys really covered it. All I can say is 100% agree.
Co-signed.
Co-signed.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I don't want to ruin
the
magic.
It's a sensation that crosses generations is what we're trying to say. Yeah.
And just to expand the purview of the connection, I also would be very, very in my head with worry about lights out, nighttime. I can't keep reading
your prison wine, not being able to get your prison wine cold enough.
Not the wine, but he likes to read in bed to a certain point, and now I'm sleepy. So now I'm going to turn the light off and put my book, you know, my spy thriller or whatever on the bedside table. Like, that's important. It's self-management. I'm not saying I want more time always. Maybe I just want to read a page. Words get a little blurry. That's the old universe telling you it's time to go night-night. I want to be in charge of that.
What the fuck was this, the Nero story to you? Like, what was that story about? Like, I would like to make you my courtesan story.
What was it about?
Well, I know what it was about, but what was the purpose of telling Greg that? No, it's okay if you don't have an answer.
Well, I mean, I think I don't fully have an answer, but as a professional podcaster, I can pivot and bluff. I mean, I think there is a desire, and this has always been written through this relationship, right? Where like, it's important to Tom to exert dominance, but the rope that's around his neck, he feels ought to be a life preserver, and it ought to be around as many other people as possible. Like, he doesn't want to go down alone. And also, I think what's written so brilliantly into McFadden's performance is the ego. I mean, Tom eats a lot of shit on the show. We see it from that perspective. But I think that for him, the idea of injustice would be him, Tom Wamsgams, who did everything right and married the boss's daughter, taking the fall, when this dummy who barfed in a Mickey Mouse costume wouldn't be getting punished.
Well, nobody needs him now, too. Like, the guy that he was making his sort of protege slash blood bag is moving on and is sort of gamed out, like, what his future at the company is going to be when he uses this leverage to become the head of a Buffalo theme park. And Shiv is essentially, like, still ushering him out the door. And while she's like, I'm really sorry, she's basically like, I don't know what to tell you about your fears about jail. I have, like, a job to do here. And I also have to go do your job because you weren't able to get this guy, Ravenhead, to acquiesce to my dad's editorial direction.
I think that the Tom Shiv thing, by the way, I was mentioning the Jeremy Strong facial reactions as where the emotion comes from. The Tom Shiv is the other reliable well of that, even though it's just sort of agonizing pathos because it's just so sad, you know, as Tom has said before. Do you feel like watching Shiv screw up or not be good enough or take the ire of her father in a way that she hasn't before, as Kendall said the other week, like, you're the new me, basically, like, you're taking it now and I'm sorry.
He doesn't say sorry.
No, but you fair point.
Yeah.
Do you wish that there was more attention paid to the fact that two show seasons ago she was breathlessly volunteering for Bernie Sanders and now is, you know, telling Sean Hannity to go a little rougher on a Republican president so her father doesn't get arrested? Or is this the right amount because it's written into the performance and the context that she is as transactional as everyone else?
I think it's important. I mean, you just have to look for the meaning maybe elsewhere than the literal surface plot points. So I think that other shows would make a bigger gesture about Shiv's, I wouldn't necessarily say fall from grace, but her pivot to the right.
Right.
I thought it was really interesting that this season has had a couple of really good sort of echoes of either past seasons or things that other characters have said to one another. And that conversation between Shiv and Ravenhead, she essentially does the Kendall Valter thing. She's like, my dad told me to, you know, it's, she's never going to have the credibility to go into that guy's office and say, this is what I want you to do. I'm above you on this org chart. You need to do what I'm telling you. She's saying, yeah, but like, this is what my dad wants. So you're going to do it. It just depends on how many times we say fuck to one another. Like, yeah. That was such a great, great line. But it is what happens to these Roy kids as they get closer and closer to the sun. S-U-N, not S-O-N.
I think I would be remiss if I didn't say there was another moment when I thought that I was going to have a personal connection to a cast member on Succession or character on Succession. But then the character proves himself to be completely the opposite of me, which is when Connor Roy, who has lived his entire life, just a life of being idly rich and collecting war parts, is just given what to me is the ultimate grandfather offer.
It sounds like he's being made EIC of Bone App, right? Like what would like...
They're
what,
basically like, would you like to run Food Network and do your own wine tasting show? I'm like, I have lived my life up to this point, you know, with... relatively ambitious goals that I've shared with some people, but one true beating dream of my heart, which that would be it. That's it. I mean, yeah, I'd like a jacuzzi too, but otherwise those things are all I need. And he turns his nose up at them?
Yeah.
Shocking.
It's
that
amazing.
Doesn't bode well.
The one kid we haven't talked about really is Roman, who spends most of this episode trying to dig up blackmail on his brother. That scene with that homeless man or the formerly homeless man is quite amazing just because he's like, yeah, totally. But like $1 million? I'm just going to say $1 million. Like, and Fisher Stevens, who doesn't really have a ton to do in that scene.
Yeah.
Just standing there like, what the fuck is happening? Well, like it's just great shit.
Sometimes you just got to get out of the way and let Succession be Succession. And when you have Kieran Culkin playing with Fisher Stevens and J. Smith Cameron, like it's just going to be enjoyable and good. One of the things about the episode overall, and I wonder if other people shared this, was like we're in the mid-season now. Mm-hmm. Like there was a slight change of pace in this episode where it quieted in some ways, not just the FBI stuff quieted down, but it focused mostly on this trip to wherever it was. And I don't mind that. You know, I kind of appreciate over the course of a season the acknowledgement that it can't always be at a boil. Sometimes you got to drop down to a simmer or else you're never going to make it, you know? And so the Roman Jerry stuff didn't break any new ground, mm-hmm. you know, it didn't feel particularly fresh but it was really nice to have it. I was glad the show could downshift a little bit to give us some of that. Now, obviously there is going to be more and it could go in any number of directions. It also still finds time to do stuff like the bunny cam, mm-hmm. which I don't want to ignore. I mean, because that ridiculous apartment
I also don't
that they moved
we
into,
should probably at least once a week mention the fact that Kendall has a child named Iverson.
Yeah, someone said this. Someone on social pointed this out, and I agree. And I think, honestly, I haven't spoken to you about this, Chris. I feel like we haven't been doing that because some things in this world are too beautiful and too
they
fragile.
Feel like they feel like they're too close to you. Yeah.
I mean, if anyone, you know, I'll just turn it right back around on myself. Like everyone listening to this knows that I was not in on Succession for the first episode, second episode. It wasn't until like the fifth that I suddenly came around. Looking back now, all I needed to know was that Kendall's son was named Iverson. The brain that thought of that, it is one of humanity's few perfect decisions on every level, not just because Allen Iverson is our favorite basketball player, but everything we need to know about the Roy family, about Kendall Roy in particular, and about the person writing the show is captured and held within that idea that he named his son Iverson. It's a masterpiece. Bravo. He deserves a Peabody just for that decision. And then in this nightmare white negative space penthouse, the fact that the camera notices a giant fucking rabbit cage before they talk about it, like not too much before it. It's really brilliantly directed and edited there because it's letting us know.
Well, he tells her he sends Jess over to start iPad FaceTime.
But right before.
Yeah.
Right before, if you rewatch the episode, I don't think I'm wrong about this. Like he's on the phone and he walks past it and you're like, wait, what is that? And then he's like, Jess, bunny cam. Love it. Like, these are the little things.
I know.
That a good show does.
All that stuff, it's like, we talked about this in the beginning of the season. We talked about it with that New Yorker profile where they do in the writer's room of Succession, they do the what did you do last night around the room. All the writers talk about that and all the details that come out of their regular everyday lives that find themselves in the show. And Tom talking about the wine on an empty stomach, Roman taking his shoe off and scratching his foot in front of Jerry as this like disarming and inappropriate and forward way of kind of being in the CEO's office. And yeah, the bunny cam is just like absolutely perfect shit. I bought my kid this giant rabbit and now he's trying to find the biggest carrot in the world.
And I'm never going to see my kid because he's not on the show, but I've done this instead to keep him alive. We talked about that in week one. Like, there were two paths. There were three paths.
He might not be on the show, but if they want to do young Iverson, like young Sheldon,
come on,
you and me are the guys for the job.
We are tech avail to show run that shit. But just to reiterate, like, there were three options. You put the kids on the show and nobody wants that. It's a cell phone. It's an unforced error. Choice number two, pretend they never happened. Okay, we are in. We would have respected that and accepted it. But the better version is, if you use this three times, I don't know why, but it hang a lantern on it. We're going to point out that there's this two children-sized absence inside of Kendall's life.
Yes.
And we're going to use it to elucidate emotional things or make bunny jokes. Last thing, I feel like we're wrapping up, but Kieran Culkin is hosting SNL this week. You and I are not, I don't think, at this point, big SNL
watchers. This pod will have been up by the time it already happened, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Good point. So we're recording this on Friday. So this, I don't know if this will be entertaining or not, but like, do you, there was a tradition, this is back when I was more of an SNL watcher, like, I don't know what the example would be, like Kyle MacLachlan hosts the show or John Hamm hosts the show right when the, you know, Twin Peaks is on or Mad Men is ascendant. And you're like, oh, we're going to get the parody. They're going to do the parody.
Yeah. Like, I mean, Nicholas Braun was just on with Robbie, I think, right?
But that was Lindsay Buckingham dressed as Nicholas
right.
Braun.
I would count on seeing some Succession heads on
the
show.
Do you want
week.
That? Are you? Does this make you interested in what, like, is your level of fandom at this point, would it lead you to checking out some SNL because Kieran is on it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I watch clips of SNL like when I can. Yeah.
I guess as I bring this up, I realize the buy-in is so much lower now than it used to be.
Yeah. It's not
before,
like I... Yeah.
Before clips. Like, not only do we live on the West
Coast
where it
Saturday
starts
night.
Early,
yeah.
But it's like, that used to be a thing.
Yeah, because you and I spend a lot of time out of the house after 11:30 on Saturdays.
I don't spend a lot of time out of my bed. So that would require a lot.
Andy, thank you so much for talking to me about this wonderful television show. Thank you so much to Kaya McMullen for producing us. We'll be back on Thursday to discuss more pop culture, probably Eternals. Greenwald, have a great week.
The best thing of knowing this is coming on Sunday night is that all of you listening, I am having something ice cold right now. Right now, in the future, and I'm looking forward to it. Have a great rest of your Sunday night, Bransky.
Later.